We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
We are war-torn, bloodied in battle, tired of fighting, tired of fear, tired of terror. I'm Barrett Golding. This is Hearing Voices from NPR. You heard Winston Churchill from 1940, and this is an album by musician Jonathan Elias called Prayer Cycle, Path to Zero. The proceeds go to Global Zero, an international organization dedicated to nuclear disarmament. The voices on the album include Sinead O'Connor, Robert Downey Jr., and Sting.
At the Trinity test, physicist Robert Oppenheimer recites from the Bhagavad Gita, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. I have blood on my hands." Tons of radioactive waste would eventually drop on Navajo Indian reservations downwind of the test site, effectively making Indians the first victims of environmental racism. All nuclear testing in the United States has been done on native lands. The Navajos perceive uranium as a monster, calling it Nahi. What gets in the way of a successful life? To the government at the time, it didn't matter. They were just Indians. The United States in late 1941 established a secret program to build an atomic weapon, which came to be known as the Manhattan Project. The realization of this goal took place July the 16th, 1945. At 5:29, the firing circuit closed and Fat Man came to life. The first mushroom cloud rose into the air, emitting an eerie blue glow and releasing heat four times hotter than the interior of the sun. A new thing has just been born. A new control, a new understanding of man, which man had acquired over nature. And these bombs which science burst upon the world that night were strange even to the men who used them. They called it Trinity. An odd name for annihilation.
The purpose of these bases is to bombs. The plane, B-san, Mr. B.
It was very hot that morning.
It was a beautiful blue sky day. I was watering my family's front yard. I saw my girlfriend.
I looked at the sky. I saw the American plane. American airplane. Every day the B-29 flew over Hiroshima. American B-29.
B-san. Every day, Mr. B. It was like a silver-colored angel to me. I looked at the sky and said to myself, "Good morning, angel." Flash, and dawn means the sound of clash. Hibakusha is the patient who was burned by the bomb. Think of this. The mother and the son. The mother and the son were at the same place. Then the mother is gone.
Words of Hiroshima survivor Kazuyoshi. Music by Al Huntsman, performed on a sculpture by Gary Bates called The Wind Wagon. You heard excerpts from Atomic Mother and Trinity, songs on the album by Jonathan Elias called Prayer Cycle Path to Zero. You are hearing voices of the war-torn, moving from the 1940s to the 1950s with Carl Sandburg.
Be calm, collected, easy. In the face of the next war to come, be calm. In the faint light and smoke of the flash and the mushroom of the first bomb blast of the Third World War, keep your wits collected. At the information to be given out, after the few days of the fast-moving next war, take it easy, be calm and collected, and say to yourself, first things come first, and after this world comes another. Beware of the matters not to be spoken of. Beware of such matters as must be spoken of. Watch your ears as to things heard often. Watch your ears as to things seldom heard. Pick and choose of what comes to your ears. Select and sift, believe or disbelieve. And on stated occasions, feeling a little high, believe perfectly in the completely unbelievable, thus making, under the tilt and feel of your hat, myths your own, miracles beheld of your eyes alone. Introducing, said a spieler, winking at a shell. Introducing Miss Nuclear Fission. A wild gal in her time, and she's gonna be wilder yet. And you notice I don't dare touch her, she's that wild. Introducing, said a spieler with a cockeye at a shill. Introducing Mr. Chain Reaction, her pal and dancing partner. A hairy brute, 10 billion gorillas in one, and when he tickles you, what gives? Nothing, only you die laughing. So what? So we must be calm, collected, easy, facing the next war. And we can remember the man sitting on a red-hot stove as he sniffed the air. Is something burning? Or the Kansas farmer. We asked the cyclone to go around our barn, but it didn't hear us. Or we can turn to the books and take a look-see, and then take a cry or a laugh as it pleases. They say, do the books, begin your war, and it becomes something else than you saw before it began. It runs longer or shorter than planned. It comes out like nobody running it expected, ending with both sides saying, we are surprised at what happened. A marshal of France spoke like a gambler flipping a card or throwing ivory cubes, saying as though he had finished what might be said, the controlling factor in war is the unknown, the unknown. Wherefore, we take a deep look into the unfathomable and come out with a finger hold on wriggling deductions fished from a barrel of conniving and fructifying eels. The bombs of the next war, if they control, hold the unknown blasts. The bacterial spreads of the next war, if they control, reek with the unknown. The round the curve of the earth guided missiles of the next war, should they control, will have the slide and hiss of the unknown. The cosmic rays or light beams carrying a moonshine kiss of death, if and when they control, will have the mercy of the sudden unknown. We shall do the necessary. We shall meet the inevitable. We shall be prepared. We shall stand before the unknown, aware of the controlling factor, the controlling factor, the controlling factor, the controlling factor, the unknown.
Dim the lights. The message is that there are known knowns. There are things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things that we now know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. There are things we do not know we don't know. And each year we discover a few more of those unknown unknowns.
Dim the lights.
That there are known knowns. There are things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things that we now know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns.
You know, some things neither good nor bad, but thinking makes it so, I suppose.
We now know we don't know.
Goodness, I don't think so, although that's what I think.
I believe what I said yesterday. I don't know what I said, but I know what I think. And I assume it's what I said.
Dim the lights.
Yes?
Mr. President, Secretary McNamara on 90.
Bob?
Yes, Mr. President.
I hate to bother you, but
no trouble, tell me,
I saw a little glimmer of hope on Vietnam in some paper today, where we had routed some and killed a few and run them out or something. You getting any good cables on them at all?
Well, I read that article, Mr. President. The
give me another one of those.
Official battle report wasn't as good as the newspaper report. For once, we got a break in the press.
Is Karl Rowan getting any of his propaganda people out there now?
Yes, I think so, and I'm going to check again before I go the end of the week and tell him that I want to talk to Lodge about that while I'm there. I'm just sitting here, as a matter of fact, now writing a cable to Lodge that I'll send Monday, telling him that if he agrees, I'd like to stop by on my way home, and I will cover that subject with him and be sure that before I leave that Rowan's people are actually on the way.
Have we got anybody that's got a military mind that can give us some military plans for winning that war?
Well, Buzz Wheeler is going out with me.
I know, but he went out last time, and he just came back with planes. That's all he had in mind, wasn't it?
Well, he had more than that, but he emphasized the planes. And the planes, Max Taylor agrees, are not the answer to the problem. Whether we should have more planes or not is another question, but it's not going to make any difference in the short run, that's certain.
Well, let's get some more something, my friend, because I'm going to have a heart attack if you don't get me something. I just sit here every day, and this war that I'm winning, and I'm not doing much about fighting it, and I'm not doing much about winning it, and I just read about it, and let's get somebody that wants to do something besides drop a bomb, but that can go in and take in after these damn fellas and put them back where they belong.
It looks like I want to tell time.
And we need Shoepad guy, but we need somebody over there that can get us some better plans than we got, because what we got is what we've had since 54. We're not getting it done. We're losing. So we need something new. If you pitch this old southpaw every day and you wind up with the Washington Senators and you lose, well, we better go get us a new pitcher. Let's find one. And then tell those damn generals over there to find one. Barrier, you're going to go out there yourself.
Well, that's one reason I want to go back. Kick him in the tail a little bit will help here at this point, I think. Damn good Marine coming along behind this one. He wasn't ready for it this time. He's a little tiny guy, but he's out in the Pacific at the moment.
Well, what I want is somebody that can lay up some plans to trap these guys and whoop hell out of them, kill some of them. That's what I want to do. If this Army Chief Staff's not going to do it, well, let's get somebody else that'll do it.
Well, I'll try and bring something back that will meet that objective.
Okay, Bob.
Thank you.
Oil, arms, and drugs. Oil, arms, and drugs. One. And tonight, a few miles from the damaged Pentagon, I have a message for our military. Be ready.
I've called the armed forces to alert, and there is a reason. I want
justice. Justice. I want justice. Those who make war against the United States have chosen their own destruction.
Opponents who believe they are invisible, yet they are mistaken.
They will be exposed, and they will discover what others in the past have learned.
I wish to assure President Bush of our unstinted cooperation in the fight against terrorism.
This is the world's fight. This is civilization's fight.
Fight against terrorism.
There's an old poster out west, as I recall, that said, wanted, dead or alive.
Wanted, dead or alive.
Those who make war against the United States have chosen their own destruction.
Opponents who believe they are invisible, yet they are mistaken.
They will be exposed, and they will discover what others in the past have learned.
Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists.
The military operation has been named Operation Infinite Justice.
Justice.
Infinite Justice.
Their Own Destruction by Vidar Brennonen from Oslo, Norway. The Carl Sandburg poem is titled The Unknown War. Ed Flynn did Dim the Lights, that mashup of press conferences by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. And we listened in on a 1963 phone conversation between then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara and President Lyndon Baines Johnson. Eulalie had that short Oil, Arms, and Drugs. Coming up, Scott Carrier in Afghanistan, November 2001. That's in a minute on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
You are hearing voices, and we are war-torn. What does that mean? Listen to Scott Carrier in Afghanistan, just a couple months after 9/11.
At dawn on a Saturday morning in late November 2001, 400 Taliban soldiers in black capes and black turbans sat huddled together on the barren desert floor, 5 miles east of the northern Afghan city of Mazar-e-Sharif. The war was over for them, and they were surrendering, waiting for the Northern Alliance troops to arrive. They were all foreigners, meaning they'd come to Afghanistan to help their Muslim brothers build the perfect Islamic state and fight the great Satan of America. But the bombing campaign by the United States had broken their will to fight. First, they sought refuge inside the city of Mazar-e-Sharif, where they were surrounded by the Uzbeki militia of General Rashid Dostum. So they fled, en masse, to the eastern Afghan city of Kunduz, where they were again surrounded. At that point, their Afghan brothers in war deserted them by surrendering, suffering only hugs and kisses and the loss of their pickup trucks to the Northern Alliance. After 2 weeks of negotiations, the foreign Taliban decided to drive back to Mazar and surrender there in the desert. Most of the foreign fighters had come from Pakistan and could reasonably expect to be sent home eventually. But the others, young men from Uzbekistan, the Arabian Peninsula, the Caucasus Mountains, Northern Africa, and other parts of the Muslim world, these men didn't know what to expect. They could be executed or sent home to face execution or life imprisonment. If things didn't go right, they were ready to blow themselves up with bombs they'd strapped to their bodies. When the Northern Alliance arrived, they started searching the prisoners, slowly, carefully, as they knew that some of them were human bombs waiting to go off. The search took all day, and towards evening, General Dostum ordered his men to take the prisoners to his castle, Kala Ijangi, a medieval-like fortress 15 miles away on the other side of the city. Inside the fortress, in a compound used as a pasture for cavalry horses, there was a small brick and mortar building that had a basement with thick concrete walls. The plan was to put the prisoners in the basement and finish searching them in the morning, but things went bad very quickly. New York Times correspondent Carlotta Gall.
When they arrived that night, Saturday evening, at Kalajangi, and they were taken off the trucks and searched, one blew himself up with a grenade, killing two other prisoners, himself, two other prisoners, and two police officers, one the police chief of Mazar. And then that night, we later learnt, eight of them in a room, and eight of them blew themselves up and killed themselves. Again, apparently, suicide fighters who didn't want to be prisoners. They had thought they were going to be disarmed and then sent free, let free, and sent down to Kandahar in the southern Afghanistan. So the next day, all the guards decided to do another search and then tie all the prisoners up with their arms behind their back and truck them to Shibirgan, where there is a proper prison. That's about 2 hours' drive west of Mazar-i-Sharif. And it was that process of lining them all up and tying their arms that caused some of them to decide to go for it, attack their guards, and fight. It happened very simply, with one simple gesture, that one prisoner apparently picked up a rock and hurled it at the head of one of the guards, but with enough force to knock the guard over. And then he grabbed his gun and he turned it on the other guards, and they shot five guards very quickly. Or perhaps he shot them all, but I know five guards were killed instantly, and other prisoners grabbed those guns. And then there's one terrible story of a suicide bomber charging at the CIA agent who was there on the scene. There were two CIA agents, Americans, who were screening or looking out and interrogating some of the prisoners. They were obviously looking for Arabs or Al-Qaeda agents. And one of the suicide bombers rushed the CIA guy and apparently grabbed him and blew himself up and killed the American. The other American who was there had to draw his own gun and actually shoot someone who was about to attack him. And he and the remaining soldiers had to retreat very fast. There were several journalists there who had to run for cover. There were ICRC officials in the head building who had to gun down to the basement. All hell let loose, I think, and it was firing from all sides. Incredibly dangerous moment. There were about a dozen vehicles in the main compound that all exploded, raked by gunfire, and started burning. And very rapidly, the prisoners raided then the arsenal, and they got hold of very strong firepower, and they nearly took the control of the whole fort.
Sunday morning, the battle only a few hours old, Northern Alliance Commander General Majid Rozi decided to call in U.S. airstrikes. Some of the bombs landed in the pasture area, but other bombs missed their targets, one hitting a Northern Alliance tank, flipping it over and killing the driver, another wounding five U.S. soldiers and killing seven Northern Alliance troops. In between the airstrikes, the ground fighting in the pasture continued. CNN correspondent Alessio Vinci.
So on Tuesday, we actually managed to enter the fortress after we've seen about a dozen Northern Alliance soldiers coming out, some of them dead, some of them wounded. And we managed to enter the fortress from a hole on a side of the wall. And as we arrived in there, it was, I mean, the first thing that you notice was the amount of bodies on the ground. I mean, you know, we stumbled across dozens of them. I mean, it was just, you know, one body after the other, or a body part. It was definitely a carnage. I mean, it's a disaster. I mean, and tremendous amount of unexploded ordnances, mortar just stuck into the ground. It was like a surreal scene, really. You know, it was really surreal. At that time, it was really surreal. Because, again, the Northern Alliance soldiers, they looked pretty relaxed. At some point, actually, when they realized that we were there, and there was a moment of lull in the fighting, they almost wanted to enact a battle for us. I mean, they even had time to stage the whole thing for us. And I was like, I was really under the impression that, you know, this fight was so intense, and, you know, I was expecting to find soldiers on edge and really mad and angry, and they were there, and the guy sort of said, you know, you want me to shoot? I mean, you know, you want me to start shooting at the Talibans down there? And I felt, you know, it was so surreal, again, to see all that death, those bodies, those unexploded ordnances. I mean, it was a minefield. It was a minefield, and there where there was no, you know, unexploded bombs or whatever, there was a body or a body part. To me, it felt like this was very much their way of life. You know, I mean, fight, Kalashnikovs, weapons, bombs, shooting, death. It's all, you know, it's all part of their lives. You know, these people were born at war, have lived most of their lives through wars, and they're gonna probably die during a war. You know, the problem, of course, was that as we were inside, then, you know, a couple of incoming shots came, and then these guys, you know, so switched gear and start shooting, like, I mean, with everything they had. I mean, you know, I'm telling you, they just took everything they had. 15 of those guys, they jumped up and they just, you know, unloaded. They must have shot several thousand rounds in a few minutes.
Independent cameraman Damien Degeld.
They buried themselves in the ground, they buried themselves in the cells, they buried themselves in all the areas they could bury themselves in the fort. Like bunkers, like, I don't know the word in English, exactly. So they were hidden all over the place, and like, for example, myself, I filmed a whole scene of fighting between three Northern Alliance soldiers and a Chechen inside, or a Talib inside. And it was like really, a body-to-body action, because most of the time those guys were hidden a couple of meters underground, and the Northern Alliance had to go for it and risk totally their lives. Like, that was becoming like a risky game for them, because they had really to give their lives because those guys inside were like, mad dogs, you know. They had been in this place for 3 days. There were like some horses were in the compound that were killed by the shootings. They were eating the flesh of those horses, and that's the way they survived. So they were like trapped and in danger. And I think like some of those guys went to the state of madness.
By Wednesday morning, it seemed that all the Taliban had been killed, and the International Red Cross was allowed into the compound in order to retrieve and bury the bodies. Carlotta Gall went with them.
And we walked around all morning looking at every spot of the inner compound, and it was absolute horror. I mean, I counted 150 bodies within 3 hours. They were very clearly craters from missile strikes, which were definitely American missile strikes, and you could see the pattern of the bodies, the way they lay around the crater, that they'd been hit by a missile rather than by gunfire. They were everywhere, and some of them died obviously instantly on the parade ground where it all started. Some, in fact, I think seven, still had their arms tied, so they must have been cut down in the gunfire as soon as it broke out. And then there were just dozens all in different places, some of them clearly in the middle of fighting, you know, by their guns or by their rockets or mortars. And then some were sort of pitiful people clearly trying to hide, you know, quite poor Pakistanis who didn't have much clothing, had very poor quality jackets and shoes, and one had a small plastic bag of rice in his pocket. And I think those, you felt sorry for those men because they were probably just caught up in something that was way out of their control.
By Thursday morning, the bodies had been cleared from the pasture, and the Red Cross asked some municipal workers from Mazar to go down in the basement and pull the bodies out of there. But as soon as the workers went down, there was gunfire. One of the volunteers was killed, another wounded. Amazingly, there were still men down there, unwilling to surrender. So the Northern Alliance began dropping bombs into the basement. Newsweek correspondent Colin Soloway.
And we're standing on top of this pile of rubble about sort of 20 feet away, sort of looking, you know, taking pictures of these guys covering the entrances. And behind us were the other soldiers who were taking these rocket artillery rounds, popping off the back of them, removing the firing pin and inserting some sort of fuses. And then they would take these rockets, take them over to the pink house, and drop them through the windows or through ventilation areas into the basement, and then set them off. And so every few minutes, they would, you know, they'd go over there, light the fuses, drop them in, run like hell, and there'd be sort of a whoosh, boom, boom, and the, you know, huge clouds of dust and smoke would fly out from all windows and stuff. And they went on with this all afternoon. You know, it's hard to imagine actually something like that, you know, standing in this, you know, horrendous place, you know, listening, watching them drop rockets on people to underground, but it's hard to imagine it getting boring, but it actually did. After a while, the only excitement we had that afternoon was when one of the rockets either was put in the wrong way or spun around underneath. So when they put a couple rockets down into the basement, and one of them came out of the basement and shot off in the sky, headed towards Mazar, and everybody, including the soldiers, had a big laugh about that. I'm not sure where it landed, but that's sort of what it's like in Afghanistan. And we spent the rest of the day there while they dropped these rockets in there. Then late afternoon, they decided to stop. And we went back and asked them, you know, so is everybody dead? Well, we don't know. I said, are you going to go in and check it out? Well, that would be too dangerous. So they basically were, the soldiers, no way you were going to get a soldier to go down in there and check it out. That's not their kind of fighting. You know, you need really trained, motivated soldiers to do that, and these guys are really neither. They know the war is coming to an end, and I think they're more looking forward to either going to peacetime or at least, you know, being around to be able to loot and grab whatever they can.
Dropping bombs into the basement didn't work, as some of the prisoners were able to take cover behind the thick concrete walls. So the Northern Alliance then poured gasoline and diesel fuel down there and lit it on fire. After that, they flooded the basement with cold water, a lot of cold water, enough to drown those who could not stand up, enough to float the bodies. And this was just too much. The prisoners cried out for the water to stop. They were ready to surrender.
Знаю, темно, много было раненые все. Потом половина сгорела, когда бензин залили.
This man was in the basement. His name is Rashid, and he's from Circassia in the Caucasus Mountains. He was wounded early on in the battle, a bullet shattering part of his lower vertebrae.
Много погибло. Еще много ранений от гранат, которые в окно закидывали.
He says, it's difficult for me to speak. Everyone was in the basement, and it was dark down there. Half died when they poured the gasoline in and lit it. They died from the smoke. Another half died from the water. They drowned. Many died, and many went out of their minds. There, you have it.
Думали уже не видим. Многие с ума сошел там. Вот так.
Али Абдул Матар was also in the basement.
It's very problem that's 1 week, right? Somebody is die beside you, and somebody it's can't move. You won't help. Please help me. Everybody, my blade is out from my body. I tell him, what I help you? I can't move. Because I'm hungry, because I want water. I can't move, and I can't go inside, outside, because some fire, all right? And I don't want to die. I don't want to die, because my work, I tell you, all is over. I don't want to die to Taliban. And one week, everybody inside, not eat anything, and drink some water, this water, liquid water and blood. Because somebody inside died. All right? It's not good. And you want anything to mouth. All right? You want anything for this time. You can see something, everybody move and fire for sky, all right? And Ireland's and tank, and you can listen anything only to all of this, all right? And you see, friend is dying, this died. You don't know where it's go. I don't want to come back to Iraq. I don't want to come back to any Earth Arab. I want to go to America. I want to complete my life. I want to go to Europe. Because my family, it's need me. My family, it's need help. All right? I don't want this work. This work is very dangerous. I want to tell Office of United Nations, maybe help me for this subject. I don't want to come back to Iraq. All right? It's very problem. And I don't want to go to any Earth Arab, please.
13 prisoners surfaced late Friday night. And then Saturday morning, another 74 came out, making a total of 87, leaving more than 200 bodies still floating and sinking into the mud in the basement. Carlotta Gall.
Yeah, I saw them come out. Some of them came, 13 came during the night. They surrendered at 10 in the evening. They all started being brought out one by one, and they surrendered. And all of them surrendered, even the diehard Arabs and the Yemenis, and there were Uzbeks and Tajiks from Central Asia. And they were in a very pitiful state. A lot of very badly wounded people, gunshot wounds and fractures, but also some terrible shrapnel wounds. And they were starving. They were soaking wet. They were barefoot, really bedraggled, filthy, dirty, and very weak. A lot of them near collapse. They had to be brought on stretchers. A lot of them, at least a third of them. So really, in the end, these, you know, the most fearsome fighters of the Taliban forces, these foreign fighters, looked pretty pathetic and in a very bad shape.
The men were loaded into two trucks that would take them to the prison in Shibrgan, 100 miles to the west. But before they left Kalajangi, Colin Soloway's interpreter found out that one of the prisoners was an American. Soloway climbed up on the side of one of the trucks and looked down at the men, most of whom were wounded, some unable to sit up, one lying down with a paper bag over his head, another with his face blown away but still breathing. Soloway couldn't tell which man was the American, but a guard pointed him out.
His face was difficult to get a sense of the color of his skin at first, because he was covered in dirt and blood, and it looked like either he'd been burned or half his face was covered with soot. What comes with sitting in a basement for you know, 6 days, getting bombed and burned and flooded. And he was sitting with his elbows actually tied behind his back, so his arms were sort of akimbo. And he was holding, you know, I think, an apple in one hand and an orange in the other that had been given to him by the Red Cross. And I introduced myself, and I asked him, you know, his name, and he told me his name was Abdul Hamid. I asked him his American name, and he wouldn't tell me. And he said that he had come to Afghanistan about 6 months previously to help the Taliban, basically. He said to help the Taliban, not to fight for Taliban, but to help the Taliban build an Islamic State. And I asked him, briefly, the big question which you're going to ask any American guy who are caught with the Taliban, which is the thing, what do you think of the fatwa that bin Laden has put on the United States military and civilians, and what do you think of the attacks of September 11th? And he sort of grinned and responded and said, well, you know, you realize this is a big question that requires a long and complicated answer, and I haven't eaten for the past 2 or 3 days, and I'm, you know, a little bit out of it, and I would really rather not answer that and give you a coherent answer later. Maybe we can talk tomorrow. I told him, look, this is the question everybody's going to want to know, and I've got to ask it, and you really got to tell me. And he said, okay, to make a short answer, yes, I supported it. I supported the attacks on... he supported the attacks on September 11th.
Yes, چقرگانلر جهان دا تربیت برگن حوزین بو تماندا تاج کو هزار او ازبیکلار برلشیشغا سایت بر پارچا تو زتن حوزین.
John Walker Lind is now serving a 20-year prison sentence in the United States. Another American captured at Kalajangi, Yasser Hamdi, sits in a naval brigade waiting to be tried as an enemy combatant. Some of the Kalajangi prisoners were sent home. The remainder still sit in prison at
Shibrogon. San kemastan ilgari Ankara minobud busak lashkari gaybi bilan mazarga kirdin wuzin shahi mardan awliya bilingni mahkam baglagan kahramani bistiyak gusaf shikan buldin wuzin bulbuling manchun yurakdan joshedim. Ya ilaha saqlagil bu rahbarimni balalardan huzin.
Producer Scott Carrier of Salt Lake City made that story in 2002. In 2004, the case was Hamdi versus Rumsfeld, when the U.S. Supreme Court told the U.S. government they can't detain Hamdi indefinitely without a trial. So he was released to Saudi Arabia on the condition he give up his U.S. citizenship. And this is a duet of sorts. It's Lebanese trumpeter Mazen Kerbaj in 2006, sitting on his balcony in Beirut, live improvising with the Israeli Air Force, who's dropping bombs.
It was nearly 10 years ago, 2001. Hijacked planes cutting through a cloudless September sky. It was nearly 10 years ago, September 11th, like smoke billowing up from the Pentagon. Nearly 10 years ago, our time of grief, the wreckage of Flight 93 in Pennsylvania. It was nearly 10 years ago, worst attack, the Twin Towers collapsing to the ground.
Then, finally, today, they killed Osama bin Laden. Finally, today, justice has been done. They killed 3,000 citizens taken from us, leaving a gaping hole in our hearts. The empty seat at the dinner table, children without their mother or their father, thousands of innocent men, women, and children, parents who would never know the feeling of their child's embrace. Let me say to the families who lost loved ones on 9/11, we have never forgotten your loss. I can report to the American people, finally, today, they killed Osama bin Laden. They killed, finally, deep inside Pakistan. Justice has been done. Thank you. God bless the United States of America.
Salam Osama ila Obama.
Finally, by Norwegian musician Vidar Brønnøden. I'm Barrett Golding. There are links to everything you heard at hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.